It was just a magical place. It was my Disney World. They were the best thing that ever happened to Key 103. But I can remember on that particular day getting in the car and crying.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Steve Penk.
I was born in Rusholme, Manchester, about half a mile, in fact, from Manchester City's original ground, Main Road. All the family were huge City fans. My uncle in particular was a massive City fan, used to go to all the games. We used to go and see Grandma every Saturday afternoon, and she used to live on Yew Tree Road, which was near the Main Road football ground. And I would have been, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 at the time. And it's in the days when all the First Division games at the time used to kick off at 3 o'clock. And I remember going out, you know, I'd go and play in the garden, and whenever City scored, you could hear the roar of the crowd. And that memory stayed with me ever since. We lived in a house in Rusholme, probably best described as, it really was like something out of Coronation Street. Yeah, I'd often go out and play in the backyard, and it was a house that didn't have central heating. So my earliest memory is, certainly in the winter, is it was a house that was always freezing cold. But, you know, when I look back at my childhood, it was family. It was always about family. And although Mum and Dad didn't really have a lot of money and we didn't have many luxuries, when I look back, I don't think I missed out on anything. You know, I don't ever look back and think, oh, I really wanted one of those and I never got it. But I don't look back and think like that, you know. I don't feel that I ever went without anything.
And don't forget that Radio 1 is back tomorrow at 8 o'clock with Ed Stewart and Junior Choice.
Radio 1 used to close down at 7 o'clock or something like that. And so the only place you could hear, you know, hit music, songs that were currently in the charts, was Radio Luxembourg. But the reception was, certainly where we lived. At this time, we'd moved to Macclesfield. The reception was so terrible, you know, whistling and fading in and out. But it was the only place you could hear, you know, the songs that were currently in the charts. My own kids will never understand the thrill, and only those of a certain age will understand the thrill of getting on the bus and going down to your local shopping centre with your spends, your pocket money, and buying your current favourite song in the charts, and then getting back on the bus and, you know, looking at it, you know, looking at the, you know, taking it out of the sleeve and, you know, admiring it and smelling it and, you know, getting home and, you know, putting it on the record player and playing it and then playing it again and then playing it again and playing it over and over and over and then discovering the B-side.
There's a boy, a little boy, shooting arrows in the blue.
And I remember on one of those Saturday afternoons of playing in the garden, having this radio, putting it on the bin outside while I kicked a ball around and listening to the crowd at Main Road. It was a transistor radio that took a 9-volt battery, another type that you put in smoke detectors now. A song came on by Leapy Lee. I think it was Leapy Lee, called Little Arrows. Well, at that age, and I would have been, as I say, about 6, 7 years old, I absolutely loved it. But of course, in those days, if you discovered a song that you loved, you would leave the radio on just hoping that the radio station were going to play it again. And often, you know, it would take 2 or 3 days until you'd hear that song again.
8:23 past eight. Northland, more music, more often on the Tony Blackburn Show this morning. Here come the Seekers.
I loved Tony's enthusiasm on the air. He always sounded like he was having the time of his life. And the same with all of those guys, really. Noel Edmonds and Bob Stewart on Radio Luxembourg.
This is the English service of Radio Luxembourg. Our programmes commence in just a moment, and they'll continue until 3 a.m. in the United Kingdom. We hope you'll stay.
I think it was just something that I kind of fell in love with. You know, I found it compelling that, you know, that here were these guys having the time of their lives and playing all this wonderful music. And I think it kind of just, it grew from there. I remember being out with mates and one of my mates saying, I'm going home now to listen to the Manchester City game. And I said, where? Where? Oh, it's this new radio station called Piccadilly Radio that's just started. So I said, how do you find that? And he described, what it was and how I found it. So I, at the same time, I also went home and found it. Found Piccadilly Radio, 261 Medium Wave.
It's a goal!
1978 was my final year at secondary school, and I knew kind of halfway through the last year, I'd lost interest. All my attention and all my time was about music. I used to write down the charts every week. You know, the charts used to appear on Radio 1 on a Tuesday lunchtime. And I used to record it and write it down. I used to write, and I did it for years. For years, I collected the charts by hand. So all my attention really had kind of turned to radio. The interest had grown more and more. I can remember one day in early 1978 getting out the local telephone directory to look for the telephone numbers of the presenters that were on Piccadilly Radio at the time. Now, at this time, Piccadilly Radio had been on the air for just short of 4 years, because it started in April 1974. You know, I didn't know that all presenters were ex-directory. Anyway, one of them wasn't ex-directory. I picked up the phone and I rang this radio presenter. And incredibly, they took the call. And we spoke on the phone for about 10, 15 minutes, and they obviously saw that, I had this genuine love and genuine enthusiasm. You know, they invited me to come down and have a look around the studio, which I did. The following day, Piccadilly Radio was in the plaza.
This is the super summer of 76. The hot summer days, the warm summer nights, and everywhere, the summer sound of Piccadilly to keep you company.
It was just magic. It was just a magical place. It was my Disneyland at the time. It was my Disney World. It was just walking down the piazza and seeing the radio station reception and the logo of the radio station. It was just magical. And the following day, the phone rang, and this presenter said, "There's an opportunity." As a runner, as a junior, helping out on the Saturday sports show, would you be interested? You know, I didn't hesitate. I said, absolutely. So, he said, can you come tomorrow to meet the programme controller, who at the time was a guy called Colin Walters, a mountain of a man. I mean, I very impressive. They offered me this job helping out on the Saturday sports show, and I did that for about 2 or 3 months. I was due to leave school in the July of 1978, still not knowing what I was going to do. What I used to do when I helped out on the Saturday sports show is, after the show had finished at 6 o'clock, I'd go into one of the spare studios and I'd play around. I'd do pretend radio shows and use the jingles and the records and just practice. And I used to borrow the jingles from another studio that at the time I didn't know what that studio was, but it was the commercial production studio. It was a Saturday, so nobody was around, and I always put them back in the right place, and it wasn't a problem. And then this one particular Saturday night, I was taking the stuff back to the studio, and there was a guy in the studio who was working. And I went in and I introduced myself and said, "Oh, God, crikey, I hope you don't mind. I've been borrowing these jingles today." And he went, no, it's no problem. Anyway, it turned out this guy was Steve England. You know, I didn't know who he was, but, Steve was, had worked on the I think, Radio England. I think he'd actually worked for, I think. But Steve at the time was running the commercial production department at Piccadilly Radio. And Steve obviously noticed, as you do when you talk to a young person, and they have a genuine interest in something, you kind of see that it's not false and they got a genuine love for it. After 20 minutes of chatting, he said, "It's funny that we're chatting now, but you know, we happen to be looking for a junior for the production department. Is it something that you think you'd be interested in? I said, yeah, you know, it's of course. So again, long story short, they offered me the job. I left school on the Friday, whatever that date was, and I started Piccadilly Radio as a commercial production junior on the Monday. And that was July 1978.
Oh, Piccadilly, summer weekend.
I remember telling Mum and Dad that I got this job at Piccadilly Radio, and they were absolutely thrilled. They were concerned, you know, certainly Dad was. Dad was very concerned that I was spending so much time playing music and, you know, locking myself away in my bedroom and listening to the radio. And I don't think he ever saw it as a career for me. You know, I think he saw it as an industry for people that had huge personalities. And at the time, I didn't have a huge personality. I was a very shy 16-year-old lad who happened to love music and love radio. You know, it was a huge relief to them when they found out that I'd been offered this job and it was something that I really, really wanted to do. Because at the same time, it was a period where, you know, we were having discussions about, well, you know, what are you going to do, son? You know, are you going to stay onto the sixth form? Because education's very important and, you know, you really should be getting all the qualifications you can. It's all right playing these records in your bedroom, but et cetera, et cetera. You know, the sort of conversations that all of us as parents have with our kids, you know, and it was just genuine concern. But I think they were thrilled that I'd got this job, and especially because it was something that, you know, I really wanted to do. And, you know, I wasn't aware prior to getting the job of commercial production. I wasn't aware that it existed and what it involved. But very quickly, you know, I was voicing commercials, even at 16 years of age. I was voicing commercials and promos and things. And I can remember they had a show on Piccadilly Radio on a Saturday night called Magic Music. It was unique, really. There was nothing else. When I think back now, there was nothing else like it on any radio station anywhere. It was a radio show on a Saturday night for 3 hours that played oldies with no presenter. It was back-to-back music. The only links that the show had was a link up to the news that was voiced by the person who was driving the show. So it was, you know, three links in 3 hours. But it was groundbreaking because in those days, you know, the format of any music radio show literally was song, link, song, link, song, link, song, link, all the way through. You know, you'd never get back-to-back music. Colin Walters, who was the programme controller at the time and was a very impressive man, but he came to me one day when I was in the commercial production department and said, hey, Panky, are you, you know, what are you doing this Saturday night? Nothing really. He said, well, look, you know, the guy that normally drives this show has got the night off and, you know, would you be interested in doing it? He allowed me to choose the music. So I was 16 and he was putting me in total control of the output of his radio station for 3 hours on a Saturday night. He obviously saw that, you know, I had a real love of it and even at 16 had great music knowledge. So I started doing the show at 16 and knowing that I had a link coming up at the top of the hour, I was terrified. Within a couple of weeks of doing Magic Music, again, he came down to the studio one Friday afternoon, I'll never forget it, and said, Panky, what are you doing tonight? The presenter of Country Cousins, it was a Friday night specialist show, is sick. Can you do the show? Oh, and the other thing about Country Cousins is it was produced by a guy called Joe Fish, who's sadly no longer with us. And Joe was a real country music enthusiast, but he used to script the show. Every single link on the show was scripted. So really, it was just going on the air and, you know, driving the desk and reading his links. And the second he walked out of the studio, I felt physically sick. you know, this was a proper show. So, you know, the clock ticked round to 8 o'clock and I got more and more nervous. But that was the first show I ever did, the first show I ever presented on a radio station. And at that time, the Manchester Evening News, the local newspaper, did a big story on me being the youngest presenter on British radio. Colin started asking me to cover numerous shows, really, most of them being overnight shows. In those days, they had a show called Nightbeat that ran from 2 to 6 a.m. And he would often ask me to cover that show. And needle time was a problem, limited to the amount of songs you could play. So you had to go into the library and get non-needle time albums and to fill the time. Plus, there was a live musician that used to come in and play. One of those live musicians was Howard Jones, that, of course, later went on to have some huge hits in the 80s. I've been waiting for so long. You know, it was a great place to learn your skill. You know, hugely exciting times. You know, there was a great buzz around the radio station. And I got to work with some, you know, some wonderful people who have remained friends ever since. Some huge talent. Gary Davis and Andy Peebles.
It's Piccadilly with Soul Train for a Friday night, 10 minutes past 8 o'clock now. And come to think of it, it's our birthday pretty soon. I've had a great idea, actually. We must make a birthday cake. We could put someone in.
Chris Evans, Timmy Mallett, Mark Radcliffe. You know, Richard Keys, who went on to, you know, become a hugely successful sports presenter. They were exciting times, and you know, never a week went by without some huge name coming into the radio station and causing a great buzz. You know, Paul McCartney one day, huge Hollywood movie star the following day. Whenever a famous person came into reception, they used to get them to sign a visitor's book. And over the years, I mean, literally, you name anybody, you know, anybody who was famous over the years had come into Piccadilly Radio.
Oh, Piccadilly, hello, Albert Square.
And hello, some bright spark decided, I think it was on the anniversary of one of the anniversaries of the radio station, some bright genius decided to give this book away. So somebody somewhere, somebody in Greater Manchester has got this amazing book signed by all these incredibly famous people. But yeah, I mean, just only great memories of that time. And just being happy, you know, being happy, surrounded by lovely people, talented people, and all of us wanting to make Piccadilly Radio the best radio station we could possibly make it.
Steve Pink.
See, level 42's Mark King is glowing with pride this week after being told by Elton John that he's the best bass player in the world.
Mark King from level 42 is saying, go on, Pink, make my day.
Thank you, Mark.
Stereo 97!
And over the years did the various time slots, you know, the early breakfast show from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. and then an afternoon show and then drive time and then mid-mornings.
Piccadilly Radio, make that for Lisa and Gary who work at Superstar Video in Hazelgrove. Morning to you two. It's also for Barbara Hollingsworth and Eddie Clark who are getting married today at St. Mary's Church in Presswich. And that's at 3 o'clock.
Eventually landed at breakfast. But before getting onto breakfast, the radio station had split frequencies. I think it was about 1988. And again, that's a day I will never forget because the Piccadilly Radio was one of the first radio stations to split their frequencies. Because the morning that it happened on a Saturday morning and we were all asked to come in for the big split. And they decided to bank all their heritage on AM and launch this new service, Key 103 on FM, and their strap line was, I think, music, not music.
Key 103.
Key 103. Music, not music.
So it was effectively a new radio station on FM, and playing, you know, all sorts of music, mainly with new presenters. I mean, yes, there were some old presenters on there, but, you know, a couple of new presenters as well. But I can remember on that particular day getting in the car to drive home and crying because I knew they'd made a mistake. What they should have done is banked the heritage you know, the existing radio station as was on FM and done something else on AM.
Welcome to Key 103, the world's newest radio station, broadcasting to you exclusively on 103 FM and bringing you the best in music, not music. Stevie Winwood on Key 103.
It was awful. I mean, it was, I just remember being really upset by it. And the greatest, you know, tragedy of all is that they went at the time from something like, you know, Piccadilly Radio had something like, I don't know, a 35, 37% share. And I think the first figures came in for Key 103 and they dropped to a 9% share. I mean, it was an absolute disaster. And the radio station was, you know, not doing very well at all. And then the cavalry arrived in the form of Mark Story and Keith Pringle, who'd come from a radio station in Ireland. And the two of them were brilliant. I mean, they complemented each other so well. I mean, my understanding, I've never heard it, you know, officially from either of them, but my understanding is the job was originally offered to Mark Story, you know, for Mark Story to come up on his own, and I think it was Mark that insisted that Keith came with him, and what a wise decision that was. And they turned it round so quickly. Key 103. I met my wife Helen in 1981. We married at St. George's Church, Poynton, Cheshire, 1985. I now have three children, Natalie, Andrew and Catherine, the greatest joy of my life. I mean, the career has brought me lots of pleasure, but nothing compares to the utter joy of my family, which is the most important thing in my life. And they've all, at some point over the years, appeared on the show. By this time, I had been moved from Piccadilly AM to Key 103, and at the time I was doing the mid-morning show. I can remember one day being on the air and Keith popping his head round the door and saying, "Steve, are you free for lunch today?" So we went off for lunch, and Keith said, "You know, Mark's going to join us in a couple of minutes," and he did, and they offered me the breakfast show. And at the time I was very happy doing, because it kind of fitted family life as well. We had a daughter, a young daughter, and Helen, my wife at the time, was a stewardess and was flying all over the place, and I was doing the show, and between the two of us, it was, you know, it was working, and I wasn't initially enthusiastic about it. In fact, at that lunchtime, I turned it down. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to move from the mid-morning show to the breakfast show. But anyway, they convinced me, and in part, this is what made Mark and Keith want to move me to breakfast, because they were tracking all the shows at that time, and suddenly, there was a spike at 10:30 in the morning that was outperforming breakfast. So mid-morning was slow, that I was currently doing, was slowly outperforming breakfast, and it had got to the point where it was considerably outperforming breakfast. That was due in, you know, a lot to the fact that, you know, these wind-up phone calls were really starting to catch the imagination and creating great talkability, and they were really taking off. And the wind-up, just on a side, the wind-up phone calls came about because one day I'd been reading the local newspaper, the Manchester Evening News, and I remember looking through the ads one day and somebody was selling, they'd advertised the fact that they were selling a Russian tank, a real Russian tank. And I thought it'd be interesting to call just to, you know, have some fun with this. And I did. I called the following day and asked them some stupid questions about, you know, does it have AA cover? You know, do the AA carry parts, and what colour is it? And does it have a baby seat? All sorts of stupid questions. And it got a reaction. That was the very first call I ever did. It grew from there. And then it went into overdrive. The wind-ups just grew and grew and grew. At one point, we were outperforming our nearest competitor. We had three times their audience. This would have been 93, 94.
But we're planning to put a bus stop outside your house.
What, outside our house? Here?
Yes, we are. The reason that I'm calling you, really, is to let you know we were putting it in writing to you in the next couple of days. But, you know, we do always like to make contact with the household, first of all, to let them know that it's about to happen. So if you do see men outside your house today, strange men measuring up, that's...
How is it they're putting a bus stop?
Sorry?
How is it they're putting a bus stop? What sort of a bus? Is it a double-decker or a single-decker?
Well, we'll be using various buses on the route.
I think Keith Pringle left Key 103, it's either late 95 or early 96, to go and set up Heart FM in London. And Keith and I kind of kept in touch because, you know, he's a nice guy, I liked him. So, you know, we'd occasionally, you know, exchange, you know, the odd phone call here and there. Anyway, during Euro 96... And it's strange how certain things, you know, you never forget. Euro 96, England were playing, I think they were playing Holland. And I had this idea to offer to Keith a weekend show, a show that I could record for his new Heart FM. I tell you how the thought came into my head, because I'd heard, it was either, I can't, you know, it's a few years ago now, I can't remember who told me, but I'd heard that their breakfast show wasn't doing very well. They'd launched with a comedian that was doing it, I think. It wasn't going as swimmingly well, obviously, as Keith had hoped. Anyway, I had this idea. And Keith went, oh, yeah, that's a, you know, interesting idea. Leave it with me. Anyway, 24 hours later, he calls me back and says, I've been thinking about your idea. Would you be interested in something a little bigger? Would you be interested in coming to do the breakfast show? So I says, wow, Keith, I said, that's interesting. Let me talk to Helen, my wife, and I'll also talk to Michael, because at this time I just got myself an agent. Michael Cohen, who was based in London and looked after Jeremy Beadle and many others, so I had a conversation with Michael and explained, you know, the conversation I'd had with Keith. And Michael said, well, look, I think I should have a conversation with Richard Park at Capital because, you know, I've had conversations with Richard about you. You know, he's well aware of what's happening in Manchester and the success that you're enjoying. And we've talked about you a few times. So let me just speak to him and I'll get back to you. OK, so that's what happened. And 24 hours later, Michael came back to me and said, look, Richard would really like to talk to you. So within 30 minutes of that conversation, I've got Richard Park on the phone.
Morning, Key 103.
Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, good morning.
Listen, I'd really like to wish you all the best in London, mate.
That's very nice of you.
Again, 24 hours later, my agent calls me back and says, Richard Park would like to see you. Because at this point, we'd never met. I'd never met Richard. My agent arranged on the very same day for me to go and see Richard Park at Capital and then to go across and see Keith at Heart. There was no secret made of this. You know, both parties were made aware of what was going to happen. So I finished my show on a Friday at Key 103, jumped on a train at Piccadilly train station. I went to Capital first and then from Capital went over to Heart later. I can remember walking from Euston train station to Capital Radio, and I'd never been to Capital before, but I walked into this, you know, huge reception. And your first impression when you arrive at Capital is that you think that Capital, as I'm sure many listeners did at the time, believe that Euston Tower, the whole tower, was Capital Radio, when of course it wasn't. It was, you know, they were sort of pretty much the ground floor, and you know, I said it's Steve Penn come to see Richard Park, and somebody came down for me, and I went into the offices to meet Richard, and from the very first moment I met Richard, I liked him. I'd never met him before. I'd also never, at this time, I'd never heard the stories about Richard, you know, in the times when, you know, and there's some interesting stories about Richard over the years. But I just found him utterly charming. I found him wonderful company. And I also saw that he genuinely wanted me to come and work for Capital. I just saw it as something very genuine. And then during the meeting, he said, look, I know you've got to go over to Heart, but he said, I'd like to go and show you our new building that we're moving into in the new year. You know, we jumped in a cab, we went down to Leicester Square, And, you know, we had to put the hard hats on, and it really was a building site. And we walked round, and he said, you know, this is where Capital Gold's going to be, this is where Capital FM's going to be. And then he took me up to the sixth floor, and again, I'll never forget this. And we walked out, and he said, Penky, how's that for a studio clock? And I looked, and he was pointing at Big Ben, and you could see Big Ben from the offices of what was going to be, you know, the new Capital Radio building. And I can remember getting in the cab to take me to Hart, and I'd made my decision.
London's number one hit music station.
London's number one hit music station.
95.8 Capital FM.
When I got to Hart, they couldn't have been any nicer to me and any more welcoming, and everybody came out, you know. All the management team, and I met Chris Wright, who at the time was the owner of Hart, and you know, everybody was so nice, which made it even more difficult, because as they gave me the guided tour of Hart, I knew I'd already made up my mind. You know, obviously at that time, you know, they didn't have wonderful figures, and Capital Radio was the heritage radio station and the far bigger brand. It wasn't anything to do with that. I didn't choose the brand. I chose Richard Park.
Radio stands separate from the Spotify's, Pandora's, the bloggers, all these sort of things. Radio is about that communication and that one-to-one relationship that you have on a daily basis with individuals, alone, in your room at night. For some people, that's a very special experience.
I think Richard Park is the most impressive person I've ever worked with and worked for in radio. And I've worked with some incredible people, but I just found him so... He was so supportive and so, you know, he gave me the freedom to go on and be creative. And, you know, I mean, if he hadn't have been my boss, he could have been one of my best friends. You know, he was a wonderful company socially and just a joy to work for because he got it. What some people tend to forget about Richard is that, you know, when Richard was a presenter, he was also a great presenter. You know, and he was creative, and he understood creative people, and he understood that, you know, occasionally, you know, when you take risks, you're going to get some things wrong. You know, you might get two or three things wrong, but you might get within that some real nuggets. And as I say, you know, he absolutely got me from day one, and I loved it. You know, I loved working for him. And we had a meeting every morning. I mean, by this time I was doing the mid-morning show on Capital FM straight after Terence Breakfast Show. So I was doing 10 till 1 every day.
Thank you, top 10 at 10. What is the year?
Capital FM. Top 10 at 10.
And we'd have a daily meeting at 8:30, and we'd go through the music together for that morning show, and you know, he'd give me the freedom to choose some of those songs, and you know, and this was at a time when playlists were becoming, you know, you couldn't even move a song, you know, never mind choose a song, you know, you were given your playlist and you will play those songs in the order that they're printed on your running order. Well, you know, again, Richard was, you know, he'd give you the freedom to, you know, to move things and do things. And, you know, if I was, for example, doing a George Michael song title phone call where I've got to get as many George Michael song titles into a 3-minute conversation, you know, he'd let me just, you know, pull out a George Michael song and play it after the call. You know, I mean, just little things like that, you know, little things that make things better. And I had the creative peace of mind to know when I went on the air that, you know, Richard wouldn't hit the roof if I did something like that. As, you know, as a broadcaster, as somebody, you know, as a creative broadcaster, it's nice to know that you're working for somebody like that who gets it, who absolutely, you know, understands what it is you're trying to do. And the day that I did the Blair call, the Tony Blair wind-up call, is kind of a perfect example of the relationship that we had. Because the day before I did the call, I'd rung up my mate John Coleshaw, who you know, who was trying to break into the London market at the time, and it kind of wasn't happening for John, you know, because it's a massively competitive market, obviously, for you know, for new impressionists trying to make a mark. And John, you know, I'd had conversations with John, and John was saying that, you know, he was thinking of moving back north because it wasn't happening for him. And so I kind of created a little slot on John, for John, to try and let him make a mark in London, and started doing a few more impression calls where, you know, whenever John appeared on my show, you know, he'd shine for 3 minutes. It was like this, you know, the greatest stage in Europe, and putting the spotlight on him and saying, look, everybody, look how great this guy is. So I, you know, I'd rung John that I had this idea to try and ring Tony Blair, and my thought process on the call was the entertainment value that was going to come from trying to get through the security of, you know, the 10 Downing Street switchboard. So that was the idea behind the call. So I rang John the night before and said, look, can you do a William Hague impression? And he did the impression for me down the phone, and it was just brilliant. It was like you were talking to William Hague. So I said, look, you know, can you meet me at the studio tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock? And at 20 past eight, we went into one of the production studios. We started the call and managed to convince the switchboard operator that it was William Hague.
All right, it's William Hague. I just wondered if Tony was available.
Pretty switcher number 10, how's it going?
Thank you very much indeed.
The call went silent while she put us on hold, and then came back and said, "Oh, Cherie's just trying to find him.
We'll keep you a moment."
And then the call went silent again, and I took the headphones off and I said to John, "He's going to come to the phone. You've got to be prepared. He's going to pick up the phone." And the second he picked up the phone, I knew it was a new story. This was a special moment. So we did the call, and the call finished, and John left, because I had an 8:30 meeting I had every day with Richard to go through that day's show and make a few tweaks here and there. I got in the lift to go from the third floor of Leicester Square up to his office on the sixth floor, and I knew at that moment I had a decision to make, because when I got in that meeting, and he asked me the question, what have you got on the show today, Steve? If I turned round to him and said, well, I've just done this incredible phone call to the British Prime Minister where we've tried to wind him up and he's actually come on the phone, I knew Richard's next question to me as the programme director of Capital Radio would have to be, have you got permission? And of course, my answer to that question would have been, well, no, I haven't. And his next point would have been, well, you can't play it then. So I took the decision not to tell Richard, because I didn't want to put him in a position where he would have to ask those questions and he'd have no choice. He'd have no choice but to stop me playing it, because, you know, it's his job. Finished our meeting about 10 to 9. Went downstairs, edited the call. It didn't need a lot of editing, apart from taking out some huge gaps while the phone operator had gone to try and find Tony Blair. The finished call that you hear is pretty much the way that it played out on that day. Started the show at 10 o'clock, knowing obviously all the time that I've got this wind-up coming up at 11:30, where I'm winding up the British Prime Minister. And it kind of grew in my mind as the minutes ticked by that, and when I say it grew in my mind, is that I knew that if this goes spectacularly wrong, it's the end of my career. I'm kind of slightly getting cold feet in that I'm thinking, well, if this goes horribly wrong, you know, this is going to be the end of a beautiful career. Anyway, we got to 11:30 and I set up the call and played the call and then finished off the show.
You must have taken them in very well in the switchboard.
Well, no, all it was, I mean, I was talking to, John Prescott the other day, and he said that you wanted, you know, that share exercise video that you were interested in having? Well, it's just that, you know, we went to the car boot sale, me and Fionn, around the corner, and we've managed to find it. And so we've got that copy, and perhaps I can, you know, let you have it in the Commons later today.
Well, I think it would be very helpful. Just hand it over at Prime Minister's questions.
Nothing really happened between, you know, me playing the call and the show finishing, and then I left the building and I, you know, made my merry way home. And then about whatever time it was, 2:15, 2:30, I'm listening to Martin Collins, who did the show after me. And Martin says, and this has just happened in the House of Commons. And Tony Blair announces at Prime Minister's Question Time that he's just been wound up by Steve Penk on Capital Radio. And then all hell did break loose, because then I literally had every newspaper, every television company trying to contact me and interview me. I had interviews with television stations in Australia and America and, you know, just literally all over the place. That evening in my house, it was surreal, because I had a BBC satellite crew set up in the lounge in my home. This is at home. I had ITV breakfast crew in the hall. I had ITV main news in our family room, and I was doing a live Sky telephone news interview on the phone somewhere else in the house. It was just a surreal moment. Well, that night it was lead story on the 9 o'clock news, the main, what was then 9 o'clock news on the BBC and the 10 o'clock news on ITV and lead news on Sky. And then the following morning, so I get in and everybody's talking about it. You know, Chris Tarrant's replaying the call every 15 minutes on breakfast, or clips from the call. And it's just a huge, huge story. So I go in to start my show that morning. As it turns out, that morning, there wasn't a meeting with Richard. He had to go out to he had a meeting that morning, and so we couldn't have our daily 8:30. So I hadn't seen Richard or spoken to him at all. So I start the show at 10 o'clock, get into my first record, and the door of the studio flings open, and Richard stood in the framework of the doorway, doesn't say a word, and just starts applauding me. And never said a word, because he knew what I'd done. You know, he knew that I'd taken full and total responsibility of playing this thing on the air, because he knew, you know, he also knew that if I'd mentioned it to him, he would have had to ask me, you know, did I get permission to use it? And no, we hadn't. And then he would have had to stop me playing it. So, you know, he stood there applauding me, and we never spoke about it. And we haven't spoken about it from that day to this day. And it's ironic, really, that I'm telling you this story now, because it happened 20 years ago, exactly this month. It was an incredible moment because everybody benefited. It was one of those unique moments, you know, in entertainment, really, where every single party benefited. I mean, at the time, and I can't remember the politics involved, but at the time, Tony Blair was under incredible pressure. And for a few days, this took the pressure off him about that particular issue that was going on. Blair came across as the good guy with a great sense of humour. And so, you know, it ticked a great box for him. It made John Coleshaw famous. You know, it was the thing that John had been looking for. You know, suddenly people knew who John was as an impressionist. So that was a huge tick. And for that brief moment, it made me, you know, it made me personally one of the most famous radio presenters in the world. And, you know, when you do this for a living, you know, when you are a broadcaster, you know, if you can have just one of those moments in your life, you can't ask for more than that. So it was a very special moment. Many cynical journalists believed that it had all been set up through Alistair Campbell. You know, they believed that Alistair Campbell had set up this phone call, and, you know, it had all been staged. It couldn't be further from the truth. It absolutely wasn't.
Penky, what's he playing at? He drives me nuts. At breakfast
time he's such a lousy loser. He drives me nuts. He's got such lousy hair and a poor complexion.
The whole Virgin experience was probably the darkest period of my career. I've always believed this, that, you know, don't regret the things you've done, regret the things you haven't done. So I have no regrets taking the gig, because I'd be sat here now thinking, I wonder what would have happened if. But looking back on it now, if I'm really honest, I made the decision to go to Virgin for the wrong reasons. It was a financial decision that I made, because Virgin Radio offered me so much money to go there. And it became a financial decision instead of what I've always made my decisions on, you know, creatively, is it the right thing to do? But at that time, you know, I'd done a lot, and I'd done all the telly, and I'd, you know, achieved a lot. And suddenly they came along with this incredible amount of money. I mean, there was a period where I was the highest paid radio presenter in the United Kingdom. I mean, Capital offered me a brilliant deal to stay. You know, when I look back at that now, it was an amazing deal to stay. But, you know, Virgin topped it. And, you know, it was an incredible deal that they offered me. And that whole period with Chris, you know, you forget how big that the story was. I mean, at the time that they fired Chris and they replaced Chris on Breakfast with myself, it was headline news.
Soho, the head of Virgin Radio, and listen to a statement from station executives there about the future of Chris Evans.
I can confirm on behalf of Virgin Radio that Chris Evans is no longer a presenter at the station. He has been in breach of his contract, and we were left with no option but to terminate it. There will be a new Virgin Breakfast radio show hosted by Steve Penk starting on 9th of July. Thank you.
It was headline news at News at 10. It was headline news on the BBC. You know, Chris Evans has been fired. You know, Steve Penk is replacing Chris on Virgin Radio Breakfast. You know, it was a massive story. But I was never happy at Virgin. I mean, almost from day one, it never felt comfortable to me. You know, it was just, you know, I never felt comfortable. I didn't even like the building.
Across the UK. That's a scary thought. This is Steve Peck.
Also, I hope you had a good weekend. I spent most of my weekend thundering up and down various motorways. Oh, how I love the motorway network.
After Virgin returned to Capital to do a new show that they were launching, a networked late show. They wanted to do something that they'd never done before. They wanted something that was a bit edgy. So they really wanted me to take some risks and, you know, to do stuff that we'd never done before at night. And the show was networked live across a number of their radio stations at the time, mostly across the South Coast and BRMB and Red Dragon in Wales and a number of other stations. It worked in some areas and didn't work in other areas. And technically, there were problems as well, because it was the early days of trying to do stuff like this. So I'd take a break at the studio in London and it wouldn't fire some of the breaks in some of the other regions. So the station would simply go off air. But, you know, they tried it and it was great to be, you know, to be part of that. And we did it for about a year.
No, Kylie. For the next 3 hours.
And then I did a show for Fox in Oxfordshire for a while. It was commutable from my home in Surrey. And did that for about a year and loved that. Again, because they gave me creative freedom. And the people that I worked with were great. But after a year of doing that, the commute became really a pain in the arse. So I didn't want to do that anymore. And that took us to kind of January 2008. And it was around about this time that I started thinking about, okay, what am I going to do next? You know, I've done most things now, but I want to try and do something a little different. And I wanted to explore the possibility of radio station ownership, but it had to make commercial sense. So for it to make commercial sense, it either had to be a station, you know, London area because of, you know, Capital Radio and a bit of Virgin, or Manchester because of Piccadilly Radio and Key 103. And The Revolution became available. At the time, it was jointly owned between UKRD and the Oldham Chronicle. And for one reason or another, they decided that they wanted to sell, and they wanted to sell it quickly. And because they wanted to sell it quickly, you know, it was a reasonable price at the time. So I went through the whole of due diligence and I signed in the lawyer's office on the Thursday, and on the Friday of that week, The Lehman Brothers went bust in America. And that was the start of that financial crash, you know, late 2008. And unless you owned a business during that time, you literally can't put into words how tough it was. It was brutal. I mean, it's the only word that describes it. It was just totally and utterly brutal. Plus the fact that I was, you know, living away from home. That was tough. And all the shutters came down at the banks. And the first thing that happens with a lot of companies in financial tough times is they suspend their advertising and marketing budgets, or they vastly reduce them. And that has an impact, certainly on a radio station the size of the Revolution. And that's very much what happened. It was very, very hard. It was a very, very tough period. But again, I have no regrets, you know, of it was something that I wanted to try. It didn't work out in terms of it being what I wanted it to be. I mean, it worked out in the fact, you know, creatively, that I managed to, you know, during my ownership, quadruple the audience size and double the revenues. But it wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't, you know, the costs were considerable. And, you know, I couldn't afford to rent a house or rent an apartment. So I lived in a converted storeroom for 5 years. And it literally was. It had no windows. It was a storeroom that had been full of junk that we'd cleared out and put a bed in and TV and a lamp. And that was my home during the week for 5.5 years. But, you know, it was what it was. And in late 2013, I decided, you know, I need to get out of here, because if I don't get out of here, it's going to kill me. And so, you know, January 14, I sold the radio station. Might as well jump. I sold the Revolution in January 2014, and then really took a year out where I did virtually nothing. The previous 6 years of owning and running the radio station have been so intense, so much stress. How it didn't kill me, I'll never know. So I took a year out, and then after a year, I started to think about, you know, the next thing I wanted to do. And one day I got a phone call from John Evington. John and I had first met in the late 70s at Piccadilly Radio, and then I'd hired John as my station manager at The Revolution. Anyway, he said that he was launching a small-scale multiplex in Manchester with David Duffy, and would I be interested in launching my own radio station on the multiplex? And John suggested launching a wind-up channel, a radio station 24 hours a day that would play my wind-up phone calls. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, is there anything else currently like this anywhere? Yeah, because I wanted it to be different and kind of unique. And there isn't anything, you know, there isn't anything on UK radio like this. But I wanted it to be more than just my own phone calls. So, you know, the radio station showcases others around the world that do wind-up prank phone calls. And it is an interesting listen. You know, I know that the wind-up phone calls polarise an audience. They always have done. So, you know, it's either your thing or it's not your thing. And it is currently on DAB Plus in Manchester, along with another radio station I've created called Radio Dead. It's a globally unique idea. You know, a radio station 24 hours a day that only plays artists who are sadly no longer with us. You know, when I first had the idea, it's like any simple idea. You know, my first thought was somebody must have done this. And my knowledge of UK radio is pretty good. So I knew that nobody in the UK had done it. But I thought, you know, somebody in America must have done this, or, you know, somebody in Australia must have done this. And they hadn't. So I'm proud of that. And technology allows me to do things now that, you know, you simply couldn't have done years ago. You know, to create a radio station like Radio Dead or the wind-up channel, these things you simply couldn't have done years ago.
24 hours a day, every day, this is Radio Dead, where the music never dies.
You know, I don't listen to as much radio now as I used to do, because it doesn't thrill me as much, traditional radio. I personally find too much of it is just too bland. I find at the moment it's the internet people, you know, that are that are being the, you know, the creative leaders. They're the ones that are coming up with the new and the fresh and the interesting and exciting ideas. And your traditional broadcasters, your radio groups, it's bland. Too much of it is too bland for me. I'm loving being creative. I'll be creative until the day I die. And some ideas will work and some ideas, you know, won't work. But, you know, at least have a go.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the keeper of the nightmares, Steve Fink.
I've been fortunate to do a number of wonderful things in my career. You know, things that... You know, that many people just never get the opportunity to do. I mean, I've hosted some prime time ITV shows. I mean, the TV Nightmares clip shows that I used to present for ITV. The first one of those, you know, 13.1 million people watched it. The This Morning TV programme for ITV. You know, and it's just a wonderful thing to have been able to do, to have been part of hosting Party in the Park for the Prince's Trust in London's Hyde Park in front of 100,000 people is incredible. You know, to meet Prince Charles is wonderful. To go to Windsor Castle, you know, a party for the arts, and to actually meet the Queen, and for her to ask me the question, "And what do you do?" And I said, you know, I'm the guy that does those wind up phone calls. And recently we called Tony Blair, and she went, "Ooh, I had one of those happen to me." And of course she did. She did have some Canadian guy, I think, had wound her up. You know, it's little things like that that, you know, this incredible career in radio has brought me. You know, I've loved every minute, every single minute of my radio career, because it's brought me so many wonderful things that that I would, you know, I would never have had the chance to do, to try, to be part of. So, you know, I only have wonderful memories.
You know, we delivered this panel for you yesterday.
Yes.
£12, love.
Yes, right.
Could you nip round with it today?
I gave you the money yesterday. Shut.
Hey? Hello?
I think when I look back at my career, I think the things that I'm most proud of is taking risks and always trying to be creative. You know, stuff like the Tony Blair call, owning and running a radio station for 5.5 years and employing and finding new and creative people and giving them a chance and hosting primetime TV shows and more recently creating Radio Dead. It's now on iHeartRadio across the whole of Australia and the whole of New Zealand. And I'm proud of that, you know, that I've created that from a blank piece of paper.
This is Piccadilly Radio.
It's 9 o'clock.
I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed, you know, the early days of Piccadilly Radio and the excitement of learning something new and trying things for the first time. But I also really fondly enjoyed my time at Capital Radio. You know, wonderful people. When I announced that I was leaving Key 103, so many people said to me, "Oh, you know, different sense of humour in the South, you know. They won't get you. They won't understand that northern humour of yours." And for, you know, for a few brief moments, it kind of, you know, I did think to myself, have I made the right decision? Have I really made the right decision? But when I arrived, you know, they welcomed me with open arms, and you don't forget things like that. You don't forget moments like that when people, you know, because there's a lot of jealousy in our industry, and when you reach the top, and Capital Radio, Capital FM at that time was the top. You know, it was Europe's number one hit music radio station, and when you've reached the top of the tree, the egos are bigger, and the jealousies are bigger. But I never found Capital like that. You know, I just found them to be lovely people, and I enjoyed every minute.
This is Steve Mang on the new Pepsi chart. Who's on the Panky phone?
I'd like to be remembered as someone who treated people well, treated people the way I'd like to be treated. I'm often opinionated at times, but only about an industry I passionately care about. You know, I often hear things that I disagree with, and I'll comment about that. It doesn't mean that I'm right, but it equally doesn't mean that I'm wrong. But most of all, I'd like to be remembered as a good father, a good husband, a good son, somebody who cared about the radio industry and truly loved what he did as a career.